This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Anger, hatred, even violence has been hitting America's streets lately for a pretty unusual reason. That is the presidential campaign. The press has reported quite a bit on Republican candidate Donald Trump stirring up anger. There's also been some serious anger showed on the other side of the political spectrum by Trump haters, people protesting his campaign, and also by supporters of Democrat Bernie Sanders, people getting violent over the way that the race to the Democratic Party nomination is unfolding. We're going to talk about why this is concerning from a standpoint of biblical prophecy. Is Europe about to get a European army? There's a top secret security paper being worked on behind closed doors by a handful of European leaders who aren't allowed to bring cell phones or other technology into the room. They have to take notes with pen and paper. They're creating a new strategy for Europe to handle its security in the future. And leaks of the meetings say they are designing a new Euro army. In our third segment, we're going to get a peek at the behind the scenes of the Trumpet magazine. We're going to talk to our designer and the head of the Trumpet's art department, Steve Herkus. He's going to tell us about the joys and trials of turning all of our articles into engaging and beautiful layouts within the magazine. He's going to tell us the two most difficult parts of every issue and also give us his thoughts about what makes for good design. And I'll conclude today's show by talking about our home planet, and just what an extraordinarily fine-tuned machine it is. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. There's been a lot of media attention paid to the ugly attitudes of some of U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's supporters. And Mr. Trump has been strongly criticized for language that seems aimed at stirring up anger in people, getting them riled up over immigrants and anyone who disagrees with them. But what has received less press is what is happening on the other side of the political spectrum, and perhaps is even more troubling. Last month, when the Democratic Party convention in Nevada gave a majority of delegates to Hillary Clinton, supporters of Bernie Sanders went berserk. They screamed obscenities. They threw chairs. It became so dangerous that the event had to be shut down. And online, the state party chairwoman received death threats after Sanders supporters publicized her cell phone number. This presidential campaign is bringing out a new level of vitriol, of hatred, out-of-control emotion, even violence. And to talk about this trend, I have Trumpet writer Andrew Miller here with me. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the criticisms that have been leveled against Mr. Trump and against his supporters, because a lot of attention has been paid to that side of things.
Right. This election cycle has been crazy. I can't think of anything quite like it in my lifetime. I mean, you go back to like the Bush-Gore election, there was a lot of emotion and tension there, but you didn't have like the fist fights and the riots and the burning cop cars like you're seeing in a lot of these. And it has been escalating on both sides for several months. If you go back to last fall, early part of this year, a lot of the criticism did focus on Mr. Donald Trump and just his horrible habit of expressing things in a very crass or crude way. And we've covered on this program before comments like he made where there'd be a fist fight or some sort of violent altercation at one of his rallies, and they'd haul the protester out, and he'd make a comment like, well, I like the good old days when we could fight back, or I'd like to punch someone in the face, or just some of these things that really stir up those emotions. And it was some of those earlier altercations, they usually were just between like one or two people, and there's always a little bit of media debate over who started the fight. There's usually someone from a leftist supporter and then a Donald Trump supporter. But things really have taken off since about probably March. What's the date here? I think it was like March 11th, whenever they had that huge protest in Chicago. And that's where Donald Trump was going to Chicago to do a rally, and they had just several hundred leftist protesters. A lot of them was organized by MoveOn.org, which isn't part of the Sanders campaign officially, but it has endorsed Bernie Sanders. And things just, you have these hundreds of protesters against Donald Trump, and it just really broke out into like chaos in the streets. You had I think it was only 4 people arrested in Chicago, but they had a sister riot in St. Louis, had 31 people arrested, just violence against police, with all these leftist protesters expressing their anger against Trump. And since then, it's broke out into riots. This has become, it seems like, every couple weeks now, you have another similar riot style in Costa Mesa, California, or in Albuquerque, New Mexico, or Anaheim, California. And it's just really escalating.
So these individuals who are protesting, they're not just trying to express an opinion and saying, we don't like Donald Trump. They're actually trying to create havoc. I mean, they're destroying police cars. They're actually committing violence.
Right. I mean, a peaceful protest is an American right protected by the First Amendment. You can gather and you can express your opinions that you don't like the Trump campaign's platform. But you're getting a lot of these protests, especially like in Chicago or in Costa Mesa or in Albuquerque, where, no, there's not expressing your opinion. They're trying to, first of all, stop the Trump campaign from expressing their opinion by creating so much violence that they just have to close down the event. Chicago is one where that worked successfully. He wasn't even able to give his speech because so many police officers were hurt and so much property was damaged that he was afraid that if he gave his speech, he didn't want that much violence on his conscience. So he just had to cancel it. So it's about using violence to stop the Trump campaign's rights for free speech in his campaign. It's not about exercising their own right, like the Sanders campaign right for free speech, to just express an alternate opinion.
It seems like this is something that we see with more and more regularity, where it's essentially, this is the way, this is the right way to think. This is the thinking of the protesters. This is correct. This is within the realm of the way that Americans should think. And if you're outside of this, we're going to shut you down. And it seems like it's uniquely this way on the left, that it's a very aggressive form of trying to stifle free speech in a way that you don't see on the other side.
Right. It's very ironic in the fact that they're taking, because a lot of them, they're taking the standpoint that, well, tolerance is what you need. They keep saying we need tolerance, to the standpoint that they take it to such an extreme that they said we need tolerance, and the fact that this is what we've defined as tolerance, and if you think anything different outside of that box, you're a bigot and you have no right to free speech, or you have no right to express your opinion.
It's hard not to see this as being of a piece with what you see happening on university campuses, where if any time there's a conservative speaker or someone that expresses views that are contrary to what the common liberal view of the university students, that they just want, they won't let it happen. They'll protest and they'll say, we don't want this on our campus. They'll say, you know, this is a free, this needs to be a safe space, and we're not going to allow that kind of hate speech. Very broadly defined what they mean by hate speech. But that intolerant perspective that says we don't even want to hear what you have to say, this is really unique. And I guess this is probably the first time that we've seen it entering into the political discourse to the degree that it is in this campaign.
Right, especially in America. I mean, if you go back to you'd have to go back all the way to the 1960s to see a similar type of like violence. But and even that, it wasn't so much violence against free speech that I know of, like it is now, where they're just saying, like, no, this is the way, these are the opinions you can express, this is what you're allowed to say in public, and if you're not, you're intolerant and you have no right to an opinion. It's very ironic. It uses tolerance as the excuse for intolerance.
You know, I guess another aspect of this, of just thinking about how much we're seeing, or say with respect to the Democratic Party convention, from everything that I've seen, the way that unfolded, it was all according to the rules within the Democratic Party, that the way that those delegates were apportioned between the candidates. But the Bernie Sanders supporters were saying, this isn't right. This isn't democracy. You're depriving us of the delegates that we should command. And it's this kind of anger and this feeling of being cheated. And you've seen similar kinds of emotions stirred up among the Trump supporters, even when the delegates were being apportioned according to the rules within the Republican Party. There was a lot of, now you don't hear about it anymore because Mr. Trump has secured the nomination, but they were talking about, this isn't fair. You're not allowing us to be represented. Well, we should be getting more than we are. And this anger of this disenfranchisement among these voters that seems like it's a hotter than it usually is.
Right. Yeah. It's not and I think in most past recent elections, it seems that both major parties have chosen the candidate who's gotten the most votes in the primaries. This election's kind of different in that just both candidates, Ms. Hillary Clinton and Mr. Donald Trump, are very unpopular,
right,
even amongst their own parties or certain wings of their own parties. So you've had cases where the establishment apparatus has awarded delegates to someone who maybe didn't win the primary. That is legal according to the party rules. The political parties are private institutions, so they're not necessarily governed. They can make their own laws as to what candidate the party decides to put forward for an election. But it has caused a lot of tension you usually don't see. And then look, with the Trump-Cruz debate, there was a lot of tension. It didn't really break out into like chair throwing and violence like it did with the Sanders-Clinton debate, the Democratic policies. But yeah, it does see a similar trend.
Well, if you have voters who basically feel like if my candidate doesn't get his due, then there must be corruption. It's because the system is rigged. We were cheated. You know, that feeling of, you know, this is unjust and we're going to resolve it through whatever means necessary. I don't think that we've seen something on that scale, certainly not within the last few elections.
Especially with that violence with the Bernie Sanders supporters throwing the chairs against when Hillary Clinton got the delegates because they felt that they were cheated. I mean, that violence was started because they felt cheated out of a vote. They gave votes to a candidate who's not too much different than Sanders, a little, not quite as far socialist left wing, but not too much different. But I mean, could you imagine what some of those same people would do if they felt cheated
in a general election? I'd like to just finish by talking about some of the reasons why this is real concern. You know, this is something that in some ways we've been watching for. We're watching this escalation of emotion and even violence on a broad scale within the United States. And we've just finished up an update to Gerald Fleury's book, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. And he talks about several biblical prophecies that show how violence in the United States is going to increase. And even to a point that it's really hard for us to imagine just how bad things are going to get in the time ahead. But watching these events in light of those biblical prophecies is really pretty chilling.
It is quite chilling. Yeah, that chapter in particular, that I believe chapter 4 of the Ezekiel booklet that we're updating, it really does go through in great detail the prophecies from Ezekiel 4, Ezekiel 5, and even into Isaiah, about how foreign competition, some of these moves, you see like China locking down trade routes in the South China Sea, could easily lead to like a trade war. And all this violence we're seeing right now is happening while things are actually still pretty good in America.
Right.
I mean, we're not talking about not being able to find food or having a huge economic crisis. I mean, we're talking about people rioting because they're angry that a presidential candidate is suggesting that we should enforce immigration laws that already exist. Not even passing new immigration laws. So you're just saying that we should enforce the laws that already exist. And we've had 4 or 5 major riots because he's expressed that and other opinions in a crass way sometimes. But no, if you really got like foreign competition and you're an economic crisis, that would make things words like is prophesied in Ezekiel and Isaiah, like our new Ezekiel booklet updates to the Ezekiel booklet will explain. Could you imagine just how much this tension we're already seeing in good times would just blow up?
Well, not to mention the fact that another portion of that book talks quite a lot about this evil spirit influence that we see more and more rampant in the world today. And It's talked about in the 28th chapter of Ezekiel, just of this satanic force that you see. And it seems like when people get really agitated and really emotionally upset and distraught over whatever it might be, that just leads to all kinds of horrific outcomes when people are, they're not treating each other the way that people within, you know, who are just thinking civilly would treat each other. They're looking at each other, even within the country, as enemies, looking at fellow Americans as enemies. And you can see just how much that would tear the country apart. And it's not American against American. It really is a satanic force against America. And he's using Americans to tear down the country from within in a way that you would never have if the country were united. You know, we are going to fall as a divided nation, and you see that division becoming wider and wider all the time.
Right. Yeah. It's, and especially in the past decade or so, just the amount of political division between the political parties, they've got institutes that find ways to graph that. It's just the two political parties have their opinions are more different than any time since the Civil War. To the point where Republicans, they're starting to review like the Democrats as the main enemy of America, and the Democrats, they're starting to review the Republicans as the main enemy of America. And they're just getting so concerned with defeating the other movement that you almost just kind of overlook the fact that there are, I mean, many foreign powers like Russia, China, powers in Europe that can just really take advantage, that non-American powers that can just really take advantage of this chaos that we're unleashing on ourselves as you just let this violent spirit take over the political discussions here.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the what we see happening unfolding in the political scene in the United States. I would really encourage you to look for the new version of Ezekiel the End Time Prophet, this book that Gerald Fleury has written and just finishing an update of. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com, and we'd be happy to send you a copy of that book when it's finished. It should be going to the printer this week. But definitely something that you need to keep your eye on closely. And Andrew, we appreciate you filling us in and talking about this with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Last week on our Week in Review program, we briefly talked about a paper that the European Union is working on called Global Strategy on Foreign and Security Policy. This paper is thought to be a push for a combined EU defense headquarters, a combined European army. But at this point, it's really only through leaks that we know anything about it because it is strictly top secret. Actually, it won't be sent to national governments to look at until June 24th, which just happens to be the day after Britain votes whether or not to leave the EU. And to talk about this, I have trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's via Skype from our office in the UK. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So this is top secret. It's being discussed under some pretty strict secrecy. Maybe you could just tell us about the conditions around which this discussion is happening.
Right. Well, at the moment, there's only a few number of political and security committee ambassadors who are allowed to even look at this paper. When they go in, they have to leave their mobile phone, their cameras, any electronics behind. All they're allowed is a pen and paper. And as you said, it's not even being sent to national governments. They don't trust the national governments across the EU enough to keep this a secret. So they're keeping it just to EU officials right now.
So what is it that they're concerned about? First of all, who wrote the paper and why are they so concerned about news leaking out about this? It seems like the timing with respect to the British referendum is more than coincidental.
That's right. It is the day after the EU referendum. We also talked on this program a few weeks ago about how Germany was working on a similar paper, making similar calls that was also delayed until the day after the EU referendum. It was due to be published earlier. So it is quite clear that these are being delayed because a European army is incredibly unpopular within Europe. And if British voters thought that they were going to get dragged into this kind of thing, it would be very, very off-putting to them. Now, in terms of who is responsible, this is from the department headed up by Federica Mogherini. Federica Mogherini is often referred to as the EU's foreign minister or the EU's foreign secretary. And that is her main job title, but also within her department is defense. She's also responsible for the European Union's defense and security policy. And so it is in her capacity for defense that she is drawing this up. And the Lisbon Treaty that created Federica Mogherini's department and the External Action Service, as it's called, which is the European Union's, basically their foreign ministry that runs European embassies and European diplomatic staff, it allowed for the creation of a parallel institution for defense. So just like that control has EU foreign policy thinkers and representatives, you'd have an EU defense establishment, an EU defense headquarters. And so from what we can tell from the leaks, this is that department calling for this defense establishment to actually be set up now.
After the terrorist attacks in Paris last November, that was a pretty important moment when France's President Francois Hollande, he looked for help, not from NATO, not from America, but specifically turned to the EU. He invoked this EU collective defense clause. And that was really an unusual move. I know the Trumpet's editor-in-chief drew attention to that as being a significant move for in this push for an EU army. Really, this is another step in that direction.
Absolutely. And you can see kind of a whole chain of events now coming from that that November attack. So back then, Mr. Fleury wrote, most people didn't recognize the significance of France's decision to call on the EU instead of NATO, but it is a choice that will have a massive negative impact on America as well as Britain and the Jewish state of Israel. It will significantly alter the history of these nations and of Europe. And really, a lot of people just kind of glossed over that look to the EU without too much comment. But now look what's happened after that. So we had that push. Then we had the Brussels attack. After the Brussels attack, France really reached out to Germany and said, look, we're the two top powers within the European Union. We really need to get our act together and take the lead on creating this European army, on creating at least a capacity for a European military response. The French president, Francois Hollande, he said in an interview with Bild, Germany's most popular newspaper, let's not rely on another power, even a friendly one, to do away with terrorism. And that's basically the most black and white statement we've had from an EU head of state saying, we can't trust America. We need to build our own armed forces. And he was reaching out to Germany to do that. Then, around a month later, we had Germany's response. And that was in the form of that defense paper that leaked out that's yet to be published that I mentioned a few minutes ago that talked about Germany kind of taking the lead and helping to set up this combined European defense initiative. And Germany was getting on board on that in a very serious way. The Financial Times, who helped leak that German report, said that the white paper is one of the most significant for Germany in recent years. They quoted Jan Tekau, a former defense official at Carnegie Europe, saying, this is the time of a new Germany. This is probably the first time a German defense white paper is something like this, like important. So there was this building momentum, and now we're getting kind of the official paper from the European Union. Now, the process in terms of putting together this paper, that has been going on for 18 months, so long before the Paris attacks. But you know, Federica Mogherini, she is talking to Francois Hollande. She's talking to the German officials. And so what she's going to be doing now is in response to a lot of these calls. And so this paper will be published on June 24th. Then on June 28th, European leaders are going to have a defense summit where they're going to talk about this and where they're going to start pushing for some practical progress.
So we've seen the German white paper that you were talking about. How much alignment would we expect to see between what Germany was proposing and what the EU is proposing on a federal level? In terms of specifics, as far as what they're going to try to establish as an EU army?
Well, unfortunately, we're looking at leaks for the German report as well. So we've not seen the actual official report. We're just having to go on leaks in the press. But they're likely to look very similar just because Europe already laid out the roadmap that they want to pursue when it comes to putting together a combined European type of military force. They that was in the Lisbon Treaty, and they've pushed for this repeatedly before. Britain has repeatedly blocked it. It's been a hard, it's been something that's been very hard to get through. And actually, a lot of people in Britain after this report in the Times about the secret plan for an EU army, they've been very dismissive of this because it has failed, and these kind of initiatives have failed so many times in the past. And so we do, I think, from those failed initiatives, have an idea of what this is going to look like. There'll be some kind of a push for a European defense headquarters, some kind of layer of command staff, so to organize these multinational forces. And the other very important thing that we'll get is something that examines Europe's defense capability as a whole. And so people asking the questions, okay, let's say the European Union's decided we need to invade this country, maybe to fight terrorism or something like that. What capabilities does Europe have to do that? Where are our weaknesses? Where are our strengths? And that, and then they'll address that at the European level. And that's very important because it will make it, even though you wouldn't this wouldn't create an actual, you know, formal EU army with EU badges on their sleeves, etc., it would create a system where the different nations depend on each other. That makes it very hard for a single European nation to act alone because they're used to depending on this pan-European force. And the other thing that would be very significant, just to make this more practical, the kind of thing we're talking about, for example, is transport and logistics. So European Union, they went into Mali. That was a solely European mission to deal with terrorism. America didn't send in troops there, but Europe needed a lift from the Americans. Because when you take the European Union as a whole, there is a weakness when it comes to transportation, where it comes to sending in supplies, and so they needed help from America. So by looking at the Europe's defense capabilities as a whole, they're going to this is one of the key focuses, transportation and logistics. That's been one of their key focuses for a long time, and they're going to say, okay, how do we fix this on a European level? And so they've talked before about creating a European transportation fleet. And so they're going to start addressing these weaknesses and working out how the whole European Union can get involved in the world without America's help.
You mentioned how unpopular the idea of an EU army is within Britain and how dismissive British people are of this idea because it has failed so much in the past. It's failed so many times. You have to wonder how much it's been Britain's intransigence that has lent itself to, or that has really kind of imperiled the project, and how much it getting out of the picture might help to propel it forward.
Yes, I agree. There's another important aspect to this is the Lisbon Treaty. I'm going to call it by its old name, the European Constitution. It does allow a group of at least nine nations, which is an interesting number, given that we've been forecasting a 10-nation superpower to arise from Europe. But the European Constitution does allow a group of nine nations to move forward on this, even if other nations object. So this does involve a few more hoops if they want to do this with a smaller group of nations. So Britain getting out of the picture, it has made it harder for Europe to do that. Dislike of this idea has made it harder for Europe to move forward. In the past, they could still have moved forward on this, though, if they wanted to without Britain. There is that in place for that smaller group of nations to move forward with that. And it wouldn't be unprecedented. You know, Britain's not a part of the euro. But Britain getting out of the picture would make it much easier. The other thing I think that dramatically changes things, of course, is Paris, is the Brussels attack. And that has really made nations who were skeptical, be much more willing to move forward on this. And we're seeing tons more willingness from Germany, for example, and much more enthusiasm from them on this subject. The other thing, of course, is Russia. And there's been a lot of more heat between Europe and Russia. And it's quite clear to individual European nations that they cannot stand up to Russia on their own and that they need some kind of combined initiative to deal with Russia as well.
It seems like so much of what we've seen lately has been an increase in nationalistic sentiment among the populace within Europe and kind of a move away from or a mistrust of this federal type movement. What's the popular sentiment with respect to a European army? You certainly have always had quite a bit of enthusiasm for this idea among the leaders and the upper echelon within Europe. But what about people broadly?
Yeah, I think across Europe, there would still be a lot of resistance to this. I mean, the European Union army hasn't happened yet because it is hard, because there are a lot of obstacles in the way. And I think the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, for example, the National Front, Norbert Hofer's party in Austria that did so well, I think they're all going to be quite firmly against any kind of European defense because they're all for their own national sovereignty. But I think the other important part of a lot of the far right groups or the fringe right groups in Europe object to Europe. They object to the European project because they see it as a very left wing, liberal, internationalist project, which it is at the moment. However, at the Trumpet, we've been writing about how that's going to change. It will set up in a large part by the Catholic Church, and it is going to return to its Catholic roots. It is going to move quite strongly away from this kind of left, liberal, internationalist identity. And we see that again with in the wake of the Paris attacks, that's been eroded. And so if the personality of the European Union changes, or if there is some other grouping of European nations that maybe springs up from the European Union that has this different identity that isn't kind of aligned with liberal internationalism, then I think a lot of those fringe right groups, those popularist groups, would be all for it. So it's more this leftist personality that they object to with the European Union than the idea of European nations working together itself, especially if you start putting it in terms of Europe versus Islam, for example. Mm-hmm. If you put it in those terms, then I think a lot of those fringe right parties would be enthusiastically behind it.
Well, it's certainly interesting to watch this. We'll have to keep our eyes on when this paper becomes public. It does cause you to look back at those statements that Gerald Fleury made after the Paris attacks, when he was talking about just how significant it was that Europe was looking inward for its security rather than toward America and toward NATO. Those statements really do kind of ring even truer today than they did 6 months ago.
This subject will be quite familiar to people who've been listening to our Week in Review program, because since those November attacks, there has been a steady drip of stories about pushes to a European army. And, you know, really what I aim to do in this article and what we're talking about in this program is kind of step back from this drip of news and just look at what has happened in the past 6, 7, 8 months and take a note of the significance of what is happening and where it is leading.
Well, the article that you mentioned you're working on right now, hopefully we up on thetrumpet.com later on this week. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer, working on a story about the efforts to create a pan-European army. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks again for your time, Richard.
Great to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We call this program Trumpet Hour, the voice of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We do produce a high-quality monthly news magazine. I'd encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and check it out. You can actually get a subscription to this magazine for free. But I wanted to bring you into the inner workings of the magazine a little bit today. I have the designer of the trumpet and the supervisor of the art department of the Philadelphia Church of God, Steve Herkus.
Good to be with you.
How are you doing?
Well, thank you.
So I'm going to start by bragging on you a little bit. Even though I'm the managing editor of The Trumpet, with you here in the studio with me, it doesn't feel like I'm praising myself to say this is a beautiful magazine. There's a lot of great eye candy, a lot of cool things to look at, a lot of informative information just visually. First, I'd like you to just give us a sense of what your part of this process in, maybe your department and what you do for The Trumpet.
Well, thank you for those kind words. It is a team effort. There's no doubt about that. And between myself and Reese Zollner, who's we're both graphic designers, and between several artists and photographers and pre-press staff, we're basically responsible for taking a great swath of text and molding that into something that is actually like visually pleasing. That is a process that's enacted over several days where we produce something that's ready to go to the printer. It's very challenging, and it requires a lot of brainstorming and then very speedy implementation of the right ideas or the best ideas that we can come up with. And obviously we lean a lot on yourself and the other editorial staff who've produced that content in generating those ideas and illustrating the articles in the best way possible.
So what would you say? There's a lot of diversity of content in the Trumpet magazine. There's obviously very heavy news articles, but we also have lighter fare and Christian living type articles. And what would you say you're trying to accomplish when you get an article? You say, okay, it's time to design this. What sort of questions are you asking yourself, or how do you go through the process? What's your responsibility as a designer?
Well, the overarching responsibility for any article, whether it's historical or biblical or a news related article, is to attract people to the message, not only to pick up the Trumpet magazine itself, but as people are thumbing through the magazine to actually, you know, stay on a page and look at it and then engage with the text that's on there. And then a lot of the articles are really serious, and we really want to complement that with the design that we use as well. So the design has to sort of match the significance of the content as well. Something maybe a little more lighter, more human interest in style, and so then the content needs to match that as well. And then, you know, some articles are shorter, a little easier to read, some are longer. And then using the design to help make the article easier to digest is very important as well. And that can not only just, you know, getting people engaged in the article in the first place is important, but maintaining that interest throughout the article is another challenge as well. And then just making it memorable. You know, several years down the road and people have read, you know, multiple issues of the Trumpet, what do they actually remember? And no doubt the content is, you know, is the most important thing, but what did we do visually to actually help them remember what they read and made an impression in their mind? So that's a responsibility we take really seriously. When we go through the articles, you know, individually, you know, we just have to ascertain whether it's something that's more news-related, historical or biblical, and then do research into different visual mediums to see what would best, you know, illustrate the article. So whether we're going to go down the news route and take newsy kind of photos, or we're going to take our own original photos or come up with our own original illustrations. Those are the kind of decisions we'll make early on based upon the best ideas that we have to illustrate an article.
So maybe you could give us an idea of how you sustain people's interest as you go through and how you make something memorable visually.
Yeah, well, a big opener at the start of the article is really important as far as just grabbing people's attention. And there, whatever's most important in the issue is going to receive the most amount of attention. But once we've got people locked in, then breaking down some of the information into, you know, graphs and maps and little stats, call-outs and things like that can be really helpful just to break out the text and maintain people's attention throughout the article.
So what are the biggest challenges that you have as a design team in trying to make the Trumpet top quality?
They come in two different forms. One is called the cover and the other is called the infographic. And invariably these require the most amount of time in producing them. The cover can be a real challenge, not so much in the implementation, but in just coming up with the idea and the concept in the first place. And, you know, as you know, that is a team effort and it requires sort of all hands on deck to have that need in mind so we can come up with the best idea to illustrate the article. Once we have the idea, implementing that's not too difficult. We have a full-time artist who regularly contributes those illustrations for the cover. But coming up with something that's just really iconic, really eye-catchy, that kind of summarizes an article or a series of articles in one thought, in one image that's static, that can be a real challenge. The infographic, that's a challenge just taking mass amounts of data and paring it down to, you know, one or two, three core ideas to illustrate a point in a way that would be better than writing it down as text. And to do that visually and not confuse people at the same time can be really challenging. And sometimes when we're bogged down in the data and the details, we can get to a point where we just can't see the forest for the trees. So that's another case where we just need a lot of team members to, and a lot of eyes on the page to make sure what we're producing is actually, you know, achieving the goal that we have in mind. One example that we just produced for the July Trumpet coming up is an infographic about the South China Sea. And there, as you know, China is reclaiming islands in the Paracel Islands and in the Spratly Islands. And this obviously warranted a map on the page. But rather than taking a map or a satellite image, we just decided to actually reclaim our own islands. And using a 2-foot by 4-foot baking tray, Reese Olner managed to reclaim islands out of literal sand and use real water to make this map, just to sort of illustrate that point in a really unique way that would just be really eye-catchy as well. So those challenges, when we meet them head-on, we can usually produce some pretty good results, which are really exciting and add a lot to the magazine.
So I'm looking at the cover of the newest edition. This is the July 2016 edition of The Trumpet. It's got China's Conquest of the Sea, the same topic that you're talking about there with the infographic. We've got four Chinese sailors hoisting the Chinese flag on a little island in the middle of an ocean. Maybe you could just take us through the process, how we came up with this image for this issue.
Yeah, this one actually went a little quicker than usual. We had a brainstorming session between Mr. Zollner and Gary Dorning, a full-time artist, and myself, and realizing this was probably going to be the cover story, we just sort of came up with all sorts of ideas. And knowing that we sort of need something iconic on the page, and just thinking about the history of that area, especially during World War II and the conquest of Imperial Japan, and then reclaiming of that area by the Allied forces, they just sort of invoked a lot of imagery of historical World War II kind of maps and things like that, which you can sort of see history repeating itself now. And then you've got these islands that have been built and China literally, putting their flag in the ground of islands that they've reclaimed for themselves. And one of the most iconic images from the Pacific Theater is those American Marines hoisting that American flag over Iwo Jima. And that's just an image that's already resonates in people's minds. And so, but now China is doing the same thing, obviously not on Iwo Jima, but on islands they've created themselves that they've fought hard for and worked hard to claim that land and through their own struggles. And here they are hoisting a Chinese flag on their own islands. And so I just think it just very quickly and clearly encapsulates not only what they're doing, but the geopolitical significance of what that land means to them as far as exerting their power within the region. So I think it was a pretty effective approach at getting that message across in just one static image.
Mm-hmm. You've already spoken to this and answered this question in a roundabout way, but what, in your view, makes for good design?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I think the most important thing is clarity. If you think about what makes a good article, it's getting across an idea into people's minds that is clear. And the same applies to design, and especially so because it's very easy to design something that's quite confusing or doesn't add to the message or takes away from the message. And what we want to do, it has to complement and add to it and build on the message. And so clarity is just absolutely important. Whether we're going to go on it with a photography route or with a original art route, those images have to be very clear, and people have to make a connection with them instantly. If the audience has to do work to understand why you've put on the page what you've put on the page, then we've already shot ourselves in the foot. So clarity is our absolute guide word. And then there's obviously numerous other principles of design that we employ at the same time to help us in accomplishing that.
Well, let's conclude by just talking a little bit about the future. We're at the final stages of a redesign of the Trumpet website. Maybe you can just give us a little bit of your perspective on that process and what you've contributed to that, and what we can expect or what visitors to the website can expect to see in the time ahead, the next month and a half or so.
That's correct. Yeah, this is really exciting. Every February we generally do a redesign on the Trumpet magazine, and it was a year or so ago, 18 months ago, that we rebranded the Trumpet magazine with fonts and colors. And once we had that established, then we allowed that to flow into all the other Trumpet avenues. So whether it be the radio programs, the Trumpet Weekly, the Trumpet Daily, and the last hurrah, the last frontier is the Trumpet website. And so now that site has been under construction, we were able to implement this tried and tested branding that we have created, and that will be applied to the new Trumpet website. So the website's going to look different anyway and new and fresh, but the Trumpet branding is going to exist here. So there'll be this really nice consistency and style between the magazine and the website, which is really exciting. One awesome advantage for that is what we produce in the magazine, is timeless in a way because, it exists in print and it's on people's coffee tables. We can get more mileage out of that design work we put in by then easily incorporating that onto the website and without having to do, any extra work because the branding is already intrinsic in our design and it can be easily applied onto the website as well.
This is one of the aspects of the new Trumpet design that I'm excited about. We're trying to make it so that the longer feature articles that we write for the magazine, which we want sort of that immersive experience online that you get when you pick up a magazine. So you've created infographics and maps and like beautiful original artwork for an article. We want that same experience to be there for the person who's reading it on a tablet or a desktop computer. On the phone, it wouldn't be quite as involved or quite as immersive as it is on those other devices. But I'm excited to see some of those articles and all of the work that you're putting in, see them displayed on the laptop and on the desktop the way that they are in the magazine. It'll be nice.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And just because we live in a world, it's just full of distraction, and we want people to be able to focus on what's most important.
Right.
And that's a principle we apply in the magazine, and it's the same on the website. Here we can provide an immersive experience that's free of distraction, is beautiful, that people can stay and really digest the message and get it for what it is.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And it's one of the advantages, the fact that the Trumpet doesn't have any advertising in it, apart from just we're directing people to other of our own material. But because it is an ad-free magazine, and we can create a news website that when you're looking at an article, we're going to try to strip it down from all of the links and everything that would take you elsewhere and just say, look, just focus on what you're reading here and enjoy the experience, learn all you can and try to make it more memorable. It's hard to do that online because there's so many things, shiny objects to draw your attention away from what you really need to be looking at. But excellent. Looking forward to that. We've been talking with the designer of the Trumpet magazine, Steve Herkus. You can find his work on thetrumpet.com, especially in the print edition of the magazine, which is absolutely free. You can receive that every month if you would like. And you can look for Mr. Herkus's work in all of our publications. So, Steve, thanks for coming in. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Scientists in recent years have accumulated evidence showing that specific features about our planet must be extremely fine-tuned in order to support life. One obvious example is the Earth's distance from the sun. It is just right to keep temperatures here hospitable, somewhere between negative 30 degrees and 120 degrees Fahrenheit. If we were further away from the sun, we would freeze. If we were any closer, we would roast. Each year, science recognizes more of these finely tuned features that allow for life here. In 1988, Dr. Hugh Ross's team of astronomy researchers counted 15 features that had to be just so for any life to survive. By 1991, they'd counted a couple more. By 1995, they'd come to see yet 9 more features that had to be exactly right. They kept researching and finding more features that any significant change in any one of these conditions, and none of us would be here. Now, they've since found over 140 features, all perfectly lined up so life can exist on this planet. And these features have to align precisely for any physical life to survive, even just a single-celled organism, for an advanced human civilization to exist. The features that scientists have realized must be in place are far, far more numerous. In his book, Why the Universe Is the Way It Is, Dr. Ross says it would take at least 10 to the 700th power times more fine-tuning precision for a high-tech civilization like ours than for just single-cell life that survives for 90 days or less. What that means is our planet is an incomprehensibly fine-tuned precision machine. Every one of these features exponentially increases the impossibility that life just happened to come about here without deliberate design. This is strong evidence that there had to be a designer. Did you realize that most of the universe in its present form is uninhabitable? It's too hot or too cold, too dense or too vacuous, too dark or too bright. It has too much radiation or too few of the heavy elements required for life. Gravitational forces are too intense. Environments are too unstable. Scientists have come to recognize just how remarkable and fortuitous our cosmic location is. We're far enough from the center of the Milky Way so we're not bombarded by radiation. We're nowhere near dangerous star clusters or quasars or nebulae. We're right next to this very stable star called the Sun. And a whole host of factors make our planet's position just perfect. Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee wrote a book called Rare Earth, and they wrote, "Earth is quite a charmed planet." And it is charmed, quote unquote, in more than just its location. Earth is 7,913.1 miles in diameter. And even though it just floats in space, it weighs about 6,000 million, million, million tons. Scientists have learned several reasons why this is the ideal size. For example, if it were any smaller, an atmosphere would be impossible, like the planet Mercury. If it were larger, we couldn't live in its atmosphere. It would be like Jupiter's. Humans need 27 elements to live: hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, calcium, iron, sodium, potassium, and so on. Earth has just the right mix of all of them, with a rich abundance of rare but vital heavy elements in its core and sprinkled throughout its crust and mantle. Earth's distance from both the Sun and the Moon are also perfect to ensure it has a stable, predictable orbit with 24-hour days. Thus, the planet doesn't get too hot or too cold. The entire surface of Earth is properly warmed and cooled every day. If, for example, the Sun were smaller and Earth had to be closer to it in order to receive enough warmth for life, the planet's rotation would be dangerously affected by the Sun's gravity. The same side of the Earth could be locked into facing the Sun at all times, the way the Moon is to the Earth. That would bake half the planet and freeze the other half. Thanks to the fact that we have one large moon, and its mass compared to the Earth is an incredible 50 times greater than any other moon-planet combination that we know of, Earth is tilted at a nice, gentle 23.5-degree angle. Planets that have no moons, or a relatively small moon, have a rotation axis that tilts very chaotically. Without our moon, Earth would experience catastrophic climate changes. But as it is, that tilt gives us predictable, pleasant seasonal changes that provide variety and facilitate annual food production all over the planet. These are extraordinary features. Recognizing this, scientists have concocted elaborate explanations of how they all came about through indiscriminate natural forces over billions of years. But the book of Job provides a more plausible explanation. In Job 38, God provides an extraordinary picture of a moment in the universe's history when he built the earth. There God asks Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have understanding." Our planet didn't come to inhabit its perfect place in the cosmos haphazardly. God says in this verse that he actively set the earth in this precise location. "Who determined Earth's measurements?" God asks Job. "Or who stretched the line upon it?" Our planet's size and extraordinary elemental composition are not the product of arbitrary forces. They were measured precisely, surveyed precisely, perfectly prepared to suit God's purposes. God also asks, "Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" The physical forces that anchor our planet and stabilize it, so crucial to its being able to host life, aren't luck. Our Creator established them. Everyone who sees that kind of meticulous and stunning handiwork should be shouting God's praises. After hearing God's speech, Job was humbled. His appreciation for God's creative genius and power multiplied, and his perspective on himself had shrunk to more realistic proportions. Today's scientific revelations are telling us the same basic truths, confirming the biblical record. Surely we should be similarly awed and inspired. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Steve Herkus. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with this thought from Theodore Roosevelt. Keep your eyes on the stars and your feet on the ground. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.